Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
This experience was thought-provoking. It was really fun. I thought about a couple things that I hadn't thought about in a little while, and I really appreciated it.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Dan Oshinsky runs Inbox Collective. It's a consultancy that helps news organizations, nonprofits, and brands get the most out of email. He specializes in helping organizations build loyal audience via email and then converting that audience into subscribers, members, or donors. He's the creator of Not a Newsletter, a monthly briefing with news, tips, and ideas about how to send better email. And I thought he was particularly a wonderful guest mentor for you because of his background. And he really knows how to grow email lists. He previously worked as the director of newsletters at both The New Yorker and BuzzFeed. He's been a featured speaker at events like Litmus Live in Boston and the Email Marketing Summit in Brisbane, Australia. He's also widely quoted on email strategies, including in publications like The Washington Post, Fortune, and DigiDay. And I'm also going to include in the show notes, he's got a massive list. That's what he calls it, a massive list of Dan's stories. And so there's lots of different articles that he's written about that I think you would find fascinating. And you can just scroll through the list and start reading. So welcome, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So where am I finding you in the world?
I am in New York City. It's
right.
My home base. I've lived here now for a decade.
Okay. And you moved there from Missouri?
Yeah, I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., went to school at the University of Missouri for journalism school, lived there for a little while, lived in Texas, in San Antonio, in Biloxi, Mississippi, back to Missouri, and then eventually here to New York.
Okay. And you're liking it in New York, huh?
I love it here. It's New York is not for everybody. It is definitely for me.
Oh, and spring is in the air, huh?
Yeah, if you can hear in my voice, that sound is not me trying to go gravelly or deeper with the voice. It's just the pollen slowly taking over every little bit of my lungs and no nasal passages and wherever it goes. If you can send the largest thing of Allegra or Claritin to my apartment before the end of this podcast, that might help. Which I can just, I could bathe in Claritin this time of year, I would. If they ever if the folks from Claritin are listening, if they ever did a joint venture with like Head and Shoulders or something like that, where it's a shampoo that you can just like get, I would just, I'll take it any way I can at this point.
Sure, like a body wash.
That would be fantastic. I would love that.
Okay, that's really good. Well, today we're going to talk about, 10 years of blogging and 850 posts, and also, building some content strategy. You've got an exciting way that you promote Inbox Collective. When you go to inboxcollective.com, you arrive at a Google Docs slideshow describing your accomplishments and how you work. So that's the first time I've seen something like that. Is that a common thing now, or is that what journalists do?
No, it's very uncommon as far as I can tell. The thing to know about me is I care first and foremost about content. If you put out a list of, I put a list of the top 100 things that matter to me when I'm making something, content is number one, number two, number three, number 17, number 30. It goes down the list. Design, how something is something functional is really important to me. User experience is really important. It needs to be easy to use. That's something I think about. But design in the traditional sense of, does it look nice? Is it pretty? Is it visually appealing? Is really not interesting to me at all. Well, at least when I'm launching something. So we used to joke at BuzzFeed that our goal was to make our newsletter so good that we could, you know, potentially send the newsletters in a stupid font like Wingdings or Comic Sans, something like that. And that people would go, you know, I love the newsletter. I don't understand why they send it in Comic Sans, but the newsletter is really good. Design is just really not important to me in that way. It's so the Google Doc that I run started as a Google Doc because it was the lowest barrier to entry for the content. I wanted to be able to write about stuff that I had learned over the previous decade in email and share it with people. And this was just the fastest route to publishing. Didn't have to set up a fancy website or really do anything other than write and then share the link with people I knew and said, here it is. I hope you like it. The website, Framebox Collective, it made sense once I had a Google Doc as this primary publishing mechanism. It made sense that Google Slides should be the inboxcollective.com website. And then, you know, if you look at danoshinsky.com, I just picked the first, WordPress has a bunch of themes built in. Yeah. I picked literally the first one that was available the year when I was updating the website at some point. It was, you know, WordPress theme 2017 or whatever it was. And I went, that seems nice. I selected that, never thought about it again. So my website doesn't look terrible. You know, the Google Doc is pretty original. The Inbox Collective is fairly original. Danoshinsky.com, there are probably 500,000 WordPress sites that look exactly like mine, aside from the photo of me. The rest probably looks the same. Their content's probably better too, to be honest.
I like the headings on the bottom of the page.
Let somebody over at WordPress know that they did a good job. I had nothing to do with that. It was literally the first thing available. Truly though, for me, it's my question when I launch something is always, how do I get as quickly as possible into the content? Because the content, the storytelling, it's what I'm good at. It's also what tends to connect with the audience. I know that my strength is not in visual design. I know that I don't bring a lot to the table in terms of the arts and creativity in that way. I think I peaked in terms of my artistic skills probably somewhere around third or fourth grade. So I try to stick to the stuff that I'm good at. And that often means making choices where, you know, let's get the design stuff out of the way as quickly as possible and get into making good content, because people seem to like that. And that's where I can have an impact. And that's where I have an opportunity to grow. And that's where I focus my attention.
Nice. And you use the terms kind of interchangeably, but I'm wondering if you have a difference between when you decide to use the word newsletter and blog. I know that newsletter delivers the news and it's where we started, and a blog is electronic and came later. But how do you use the two terms?
So that's a good question. So the danoshinsky.com is definitely a blog. It's where I publish regular thoughts, essays. I don't want to say musings. That sounds more serious than I want it to be, but just stuff that's on my mind, tips, resources. The Google Doc is kind of a blog. It's kind of also just a long memo. I find that the words, a lot of these I just tend to use interchangeably because it doesn't really matter to me what you call it. You can call it, you know, give it a Dr. Seuss kind of name. You can call it a thingamajig or whatchamacallit or whatever it is. It's just a thing. Hopefully people read and go, oh, it's that. Now, what is not a newsletter? I don't know. It's not a newsletter. Danoshinsky.com is more of a blog. I'll also say email and newsletter I use pretty much interchangeably. The newsletter tends to be something, though, that is more designed to deliver content. And email I tend to use more when it's designed to drive some sort of action, like selling something. But they're all very similar and interchangeable. Mostly I use the phrases because it's boring to just write the same word over and over again. It helps to have a second word. And I wish that, you know, there's the old line about the Eskimos who have 1,000 words for ice. I wish they had come up with 1,000 words for email. I would use them all if they existed.
Well, when did your interest in journalism and photography emerge?
So for me, that was growing up as a kid. I always loved newspapers. I got really lucky. I grew up in outside of Washington, D.C., and it meant that we got the Washington Post every day delivered to our door, which is a great paper. We got the Wall Street Journal back when it was a broadsheet, and it was this thing that I used to read because it was so big. I loved opening it up, and it was the paper was bigger than me. So I always loved print. And then in middle school, I got really lucky in that I had an amazing history professor at my middle school, Pyle Middle School. His name was Steve Foreman. And Steve was a Vietnam vet, an amazing teacher, and just a super creative guy, and really encouraged us to start a paper. So a group of us publishing, someone at my school who was incredibly bright and now a tenured professor at Harvard, has gone on to much better things than I, but figured out how to design a newspaper in Microsoft Word. And we would put out a couple issues of this newspaper, the Pyle Prowler. And so it was fun to see my name in print. But the thing that really did it for me was, it was, I believe, in eighth grade. So I would have been about 14. And I was at a Washington Capitals hockey game with my dad and my cousin Don. And we had been talking about this new owner of the Washington Capitals. His name's Ted Leonsis. Now, Ted has been there for 20-something years now, but at the time he was pretty brand new. He had been an early, I believe, president of AOL and had made quite a bit of money, enough money to buy a hockey team. And so one of the things that Ted did when he took over the team was he said, anyone can email me. His email address was ted@AOL.com. And so anyone can email me. I want to talk to you. I want to hear from you. I want to hear what you're having to say. The team was lousy, so there weren't that many of us to write to him, I guess, and ask him or bother him with questions. And so he said, yeah, bring it on. And I was at a game and Don and my dad both said, you should reach out to Ted directly and see if you could cover a game for your middle school newspaper. I thought, no, he's never going to respond to that. I said, no, you should do it. So I sent a note to ted@AOL.com and explained, I'm Dan and I'd love to cover a game for my middle school paper. And I sent it in the morning and I came back from school that day and there was an email from Ted Leonsis, the owner of the Washington Capitals. And it said, that sounds great. Which game would you like to come to? Oh, okay. I went back to my dad and said, he actually wrote back. And so we picked the game and I got to get, a press pass to go to the game and sit with the reporters and talk to some of the players after the game with my tape recorder that I'd purchased at a Radio Shack. And I was like, this is fun. I could do this. Oh. And that was one of those early experiences. The other, it was that, and just growing up in DC, we knew a lot of reporters. They had cool jobs. They got to ask interesting people questions. They were always the people who got to go to interesting places. When things were happening in the news, they were there. It was one of those things that was, I just knew lots of people who did this sort of job. It seemed fun and exciting. Uh-huh. I don't know. I think if I had grown up in a different part of the country, I would have seen other jobs that I would have thought, maybe I should be a doctor, a lawyer, rabbi, farmer, astronaut, whatever. But I saw a lot of people who were, well, I was DC, I did see a lot of lawyers. I knew I didn't want to do that. But I saw a lot of reporters and thought, this is fun. And then when I got a taste of it, I went, oh, this is really fun. I get to go to this, I get to go to sporting events. They feed you. You get to watch a game and talk to players. That sounds like a lot of fun. Maybe I should consider that. Now, ultimately, I got away from sports journalism because I realized, when you cover sports journalism, when you cover sports all the time, you have to kind of detach yourself from the fun of the game. You're not there to enjoy the game. You're there to cover the game.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to be a fan, but it's another to be a reporter at a sporting event. So in college, there was a free DC weekly that I worked for the summer, and I covered a lot of Washington Nationals games on deadline. And what that meant was as soon as the game was over, I had to send a copy of my story to the editor to start working on it. Then I would go down to the locker room, get my quotes, come back upstairs, type in my quotes into my story, make any final changes, and hit send. So when you're a reporter covering a game on deadline, you never want anything interesting to happen. Like as a reporter, a sports reporter, the old joke is you always root for blowouts. Blowouts are great because it means you can write your story and be ready to hit publish as soon as the game is over. The worst is what happens when there's an exciting finish in the game, when you don't know who's going to win, because then you have to write two different stories simultaneously.
Oh, I see.
Or edit a story on the fly. As it's, you know, if you're a football fan and you watched the Super Bowl this year, which was a really exciting game, or a lot of the playoff games, I just remember thinking, part of me was, wow, this is a great game. And part of me was thinking, oh, those poor reporters, you know, they're writing and rewriting and deleting and editing these stories. They must be miserable because these things are happening the last 2 minutes of the game. And as soon as this game's over, they have to hit publish. Yeah. So I got away from sports eventually, but I always liked writing. I love the idea of being in a cool place and getting to, you know, meet interesting people and ask interesting questions.
Yeah. Well, and how did you build? So you moved to the Missouri to attend University of Missouri in 2009, and you got a bachelor's degree in journalism. So once you graduated, how did you kind of forge out your career?
So I was there at Mizzou 2005 to 2009. And to be honest, a lot of it is just an accident. I graduated in 2009 into a recession. The journalism market was really lousy. The summer before I graduated, I had gone to Beijing, China to cover the Olympics for a paper called The Rocky Mountain News. It was an amazing gig. I got to be in China and be there during the Olympics. And it was just so cool. And thought, this is amazing. These guys like me. They're going to hire me. I'm going to get a job at, you know, one of the 25 biggest papers in the country. They're based in Denver. You know, as a reporter coming out of college, my expectation was the career path that the University of Missouri kind of tells you is you're going to graduate and you're going to work for a small paper. You're going to work for the Wichita Eagle. You're going to work there for 5 years, and then you're going to move on from that to the Kansas City Star, and then from there to the Chicago Tribune, and then from there to the Washington Post, and then you're going to win a Pulitzer Prize, you'll retire, and that's your career. Congratulations on 50 years in journalism. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to skip right ahead to one of the big papers. And then about a month before I graduated, the paper shut down for good, printed their last page. And then another paper in Seattle, the Post-Intelligencer, closed. And then there were, you know, headline stories on CNN, is the New York Times next? And I was like, oh, good. I'm so glad I picked this field. So
yeah,
I graduated at a pretty lousy time. And I got lucky in that I applied everywhere. And there was a managing editor at this TV station in San Antonio, Texas, Greg Matthews, who was one of my first bosses. And Greg was a Mizzou grad and saw my resume in a pile and kind of put it aside because I was a Mizzou grad and he was a Mizzou grad. And they were launching a website for the first time at this TV station. They'd had a partner, the CBS stations in San Antonio, Texas, Ken's Five. They'd had a partnership with the paper, the Express News down there. And then they split apart and the Express News got the website. And so it was 2009 and they said, we need to have a website, and decided that I would be a good person to come help them build and grow that. And so I started there. I was there for a year. After a year, I did the normal thing that people do when they've been out of college for a year, which is I quit my job and moved to Biloxi, Mississippi to write about the 5-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. I'll skip ahead real quickly. I was there in Biloxi, did a bunch of reporting, got a fellowship back at the University of Missouri, got some grant money from Missouri, hired a group of 5 other reporters to come with me to Springfield, Missouri, did more reporting there, and ended up in New York after that at BuzzFeed. There's some hop, skips, and jumps to get to there, but a lot of this was an accident. When I talk to journalism students about it, I talk a lot about how it's really easy for me now to connect the dots between these stops. Oh. And they'll go, oh, it seems like you had a plan the whole time. You were interested in creating new things, and that's why you're in San Antonio. It was brand new. And then you had this thing in Mississippi and then Missouri, and you were building a team and launching something new. And then that launched newsletters, and that's all about launching stuff that's new. And now you're doing this consulting thing, and that's all about building something from scratch. I'm like, that sounds really good. That sounds like I had a plan the whole time. But the truth of it was, as I was going through it at every stop, I would just go, what am I doing exactly? And my family would go, what are you doing exactly? And none of us really know. And it's miraculously kind of worked out. I don't know if it's 85% luck, and maybe there's a little bit of skill in there too. But most of it is just being in the right place at the right time. And yeah, it's been a strange career. I've loved it. It's been a lot of fun. But I think if this is Groundhog Day and we were to try to go back to the start and do it all over again, I think you could run this Simu, you can run this thing over 50 times, 100 times, and not end up with the same result that I had today. It was definitely an unusual path.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you describe in your website biography that your words have been published in the Boston Globe and your photography published in the New York Times. So how did those things come together? Because those are kind of the things that you, you know, as you describe kind of how you have weaved around from San Antonio to the Rocky Mountain News in Denver to Maryland. I guess in your resume, you also had the Business Gazette of Montgomery County in Maryland.
That was in high school. That was an internship where they were like, yeah, we'll take extra hands in exchange for high school credit. Yeah, oh. Sure, I'd love to. Okay. The thing with the Globe and the Times both, to go back on, most of this is 85% luck. The Boston Globe was, I was working for, I got an early internship at a news organization in DC called States News Service, which had some partnerships with a handful of papers around the country. The big thing that they did, well, they did two big things. One was that they used to produce what they described as, at the time, the world's only hourly newspaper, which would be put together and sent to some people at National Airport in Washington, D.C., who worked the desk at the U.S. Airways shuttle. And they would print it out and hand it to business travelers when they were getting on the plane. You could get an hourly summary on what had happened that day from States News Service. That was thing number one. And thing number two was, in all these papers around the country, they would go and send over a report on which local businesses had won federal government contracts. And they would print it at the back of newspapers way beyond the classifieds and all the good stuff. And so I reached out to them and said, you know, I'm 15 and I live in D.C. and I can commute down and I would love to work. I don't care if I get paid. I just want to I want to be in journalism, want to get it on a shot. And they said, that's great. Why don't you curate these incredibly tedious government contracts? And I was like, that sounds fantastic. Their office was based in the J.W. Marriott in Washington, D.C., and it was right on the ground floor next to the front desk. And people would walk in all the time thinking it was the business center and like sit down at our computers, and we'd have to explain to them that we were a news organization and the business center was across the street. But the Boston Globe story came about, again, right place, right time. There was a day where there was this huge protest involving members of Falun Gong protesting against China. A member of their community had been detained in China, and there were several thousand people marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, which our offices overlooked, in bright yellow shirts, banging drums and holding signs and waving flags and all stuff. And I looked at my boss and I went, I wonder what the deal with that is. And he went, why don't you walk down there and ask and find out? So I did. And I walked down and I met with the organizers and I had my little press pass and I explained who I was. And they told me about the story. And it turned out the guy who had gotten detained was from Boston, Massachusetts. And States News Service, one of their paying customers — they were also a wire service to publish stories — one of the paying customers was the Boston Globe. So I did a couple interviews and wrote up the story. And we, you know, hit publish and we sent it up to the Boston Globe and they said, this sounds great. We'd love to publish. And so they did in the paper. It was just these people in yellow shirts happened to walk by that day. And I was curious and went, what's that?
Yeah.
As far as the New York Times, that was purely an accident. The New York Times was doing a story on a Missouri politician who was in the news. And I'm going to be honest, I loved going to school in Missouri, but Missouri is a little bit like Florida, that when it shows up in the news, my first reaction is, oh goodness, what did they do now? What happened now in Missouri? It's rare. Missouri rarely shows up in the news for, you know, Missouri cures cancer, Missouri solves all world problems. It's usually something in the news you go, I'm sorry, what are they doing now in Missouri? And So I'm going to assume, I don't remember the exact story, I'm going to assume that the person who was in the news was probably not in the news for great reasons, or was in the news at least for controversial reasons. And it just so happened that I had taken a photo of him at a campaign rally at some point. And this was a relatively obscure politician for whom there were not a lot of photos. And an editor at the New York Times reached out and said, we need a photo to publish of this guy. We don't want to send a person to the Ozarks to take a photo of him. you already have it. Can we write you a check for $500? And I went, it sounds great. I would love to. And then I woke up the next day and there it was. Dan Oshinsky of story.us as a photo credit in the New York Times. I wish I could tell you it was a photo that I was particularly proud of. It was just one of those, I was in the right place at the right time sort of situations. It's happened a bunch to me over the years.
Yeah, I guess. Wow. And so as you're going along and you're starting to, you know, build out your career by being at the right place at the right time, and also kind of it seems like you've got a huge curiosity. What were you learning about how you build content or content strategies in your approach to covering the different stories that you covered and writing about them?
So I think for me over the years, I got really lucky in that I got to see a lot of great reporters up close. You know, the early years that I was in DC, I would go to Washington Nationals games in Washington. Well, it was then called the Washington Redskins, now the, I guess, the Washington Commanders, the NFL team there. Got to cover an Olympics, a lot of different stuff, and just observe how other reporters did their job. And was always amazed that there were some reporters who were clearly really good at their job, and there were other reporters who were, there's a kind of a reporter, a lazy reporter trope about the reporter who, you know, if you ever watch a broadcast on television after a game and they go, you know, tell me about, or like, how do you feel? Like, oh, come on, that was your question. How do you feel? That's it? You don't have anything better than this? And I was always fun to see real reporters who would dig in and ask specific questions, or how the best reporters, and this goes back to, I remember my first locker room experience, the one with the Washington Capitals. And there was a reporter who is now at ESPN, and she would at the time cover the Washington Capitals for the Washington Post. And I remember seeing her after a game sit with this one player on the team for 20, 30 minutes afterwards. I'd come in there and ask questions about the game and a couple other reporters. And she'd been off to the side. She'd already published her story. And she was just spending time having a conversation with this player for something that was completely unrelated to the game. And I was like, oh, that's how they do it. They meet people. They ask a lot of questions. They stay in touch. It doesn't all happen at once. You don't show up and you ask, or, you know, someone like, tell me all of your secrets. And they go like, okay, that sounds great. You know, you build relationships over time and you meet people and you kind of stick with it. And slowly you start to figure out these sorts of narratives and opportunities. So I guess for me, some of that was shaped by how I saw other people operate. The other thing was, and this goes back to me in Beijing, you know, when I was there, we were publishing a blog on the Rocky Mountain News really for the first time. They hadn't really done anything like this, where they said, do you think you can publish, you know, maybe one thing a day? And I said, what if I publish 5 or 6 things a day? Went, is that even possible? And I was like, yeah, I think so. And I was kind of stealing from, there was a great blog in the Washington Post had about sports called, it was called the DC Sports Bog, B-O-G, inspired by the former Maryland football coach, Ralph Regan, who was told, how do you, you know, what do you feel about the name? And he said, I don't even know what a bog is. And so it became the DC Sports Bog. And this reporter, Dan Steinberg, who had this great thing. And I just kind of, you know, this is one of those things that musicians and artists, I guess I'm neither of those things, but I just kind of stole from him in terms of, oh, these posts are short and they're kind of funny, or they're a little bit, you know, silly or weird or whatever it is. I'm not writing 10,000 word stories. The blog posts are going to be 300 words. Yeah. And so I would go and it'd be, you know, what are people in Denver going to be interested in? Oh, hey, there's, you know, a barbecue restaurant in town. Let me go over there and interview the guy and see what his story is. Or I would meet people and ask them in Chinese, you know, in China, and ask them if they knew, you know, Denver athletes. And at the time, there weren't really any Denver athletes they knew except for one. It was Allen Iverson, the basketball player. And so I'd meet someone with like an Allen Iverson jersey and try to interview him. And I spoke no Chinese and he spoke no English. And then the interview was a disaster. But people seemed to like the idea that I was like trying to connect over something that we had in common, which was, here is this famous person who's connected and somehow you know what Denver is, but you don't know where Denver. Anyway, and some of this came out of creating content came out of, well, I told Seth I was going to make a lot of it. So I will, I guess I'm going to find a way to do it. And some of it's going to be good. And some of it is going to be kind of lousy. but we're just going to keep making more of it. And if we make enough of it over time, some of it's going to be, you know, hey, I'll be really proud of it. It's how danoshinsky.com has gone, because I've been writing that now for really a decade at this point. And I write something every week. There were periods where I wrote more, and I discovered, you know, like there was a period in 2012 where I wrote three things a week, and it was, all right, I can't sustain three things a week. That's too much.
Yeah.
There were periods where I did less, and I was like, oh, this doesn't feel right. I can't write once a month. Once a week seemed about right. So I've kind of kept it up. And sometimes it's really good, and I'm really proud of it. I share it. And sometimes I just go, yeah, man, I had nothing to write about this week, but I'll find something small that I can do. And it doesn't really matter to me if it's good or not. The most important thing is that I do it, yeah, and that it gets out into the world. And eventually, when you do enough of it, at some time, you know, at some point, you get better as a writer because you just write a lot. You get, yeah, in the habit of writing.
Right.
You get in the habit of trying to be curious and finding interesting things to write about. I don't know. It's just good. Slowly over time, consistency above all else has been the most, to me, the most important thing with content strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say the same thing. Yeah. Like having the weekly podcast, it really keeps me, you know, focused in, and writing every week too. Yeah. Kind of that deadline.
Sure.
In 2011, you founded STRY.us.
Story.us, right. Which, by the way, one of the reasons that Inbox Collective and Not a Newsletter are named as such is because no one could pronounce Story.us. And I said, there will be no more websites with names that are unpronounceable.
I see. So that's how that went. But though you profiled some stories in the Heartland, right?
Out of, yeah, Mary. I was in, yeah, Biloxi, Mississippi, and wrote a bunch about Hurricane, mm-hmm, Katrina 5 years later. And then got this fellowship at Mizzou, and then went down to Springfield, Missouri. And I had a team with me, hired a team, and we did a bunch of reporting on what was life like at that moment in 2012 in Springfield, Missouri, and in the Ozarks. And that was really fun.
That's cool. And you found a way to help your fellow reporters. I thought this was just kind of fascinating, by founding Tools for Reporters. So it's a weekly newsletter that was dedicated to helping reporters find the best tools and hacks. So what inspired you to feel like, you know, fellow reporters need this?
So a lot of the stuff that I've built over the years has come out of trying to fill a personal need.
Yeah.
Tools for Reporters was, I was looking for ways to get better at my job. I was doing this reporting out in Springfield, Missouri, and I was also in a position where we, you know, this was funded off of some grant money for the University of Missouri, but it was not a limitless amount of money. And so it was, how do we do the best stuff that we can do with the resources that we have? And I thought, you know, there should be a place that people can go to learn little tools and tricks and apps and resources to get better at their job. And we were using a lot of these. So I thought, we'll just share, you know, create a newsletter and share it with the audience. It was really my first newsletter. It's still going. I'm really proud of it. It's a fellow University of Missouri grad took it over a couple of years ago, Samantha, and she's phenomenal and has grown the audience far beyond what I did back in the day. But there is still this need in the journalism community for, hey, is there a newsletter where I can go to learn new stuff and discover new things that might make me better at my job? And she's just done a marvelous job of taking this thing that I launched a decade ago and turning into her kind of her own thing. And Samantha has a really great eye for, in particular, tools tied to data and analytics and stuff that is way outside my wheelhouse and very much in her wheelhouse. So it's been fun to see her take it and grow it.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, you seem to really enjoy kind of starting things and getting them going and then handing them off.
I suppose. I try to get them to a place where they're sustainable. And then, you know, Tools for Reporters, for me, the thing, I would have kept it going as long as I could. I had a job at BuzzFeed and it was busy and I had a full-time thing and I was writing, you know, 30 newsletters a week or whatever it was. We had all these different things. And so I don't really have time for another newsletter. I'm kind of out. When I'm not working on newsletters at my job, I don't really want to be working on newsletters in my free time. I'd like to be doing other things like sleeping or eating or hanging out with, you know, that sort of stuff. And I don't need any more newsletters. And so Samantha took that over. Yeah. Although, nice. I will say, you know, it's fun. It's very rewarding when the stuff that you start continues on, and in particular when it's taken into the hands of people who are really smart and can take the work you've done and go, oh, this is cool. How do I build on top of it? How do I make it better?
Yeah.
How do I take this to the next level? Because there's something, the starting stuff is really hard and can be, you know, pretty intense process.
Absolutely.
And at a certain point, you just go like, I don't know how much further I can take it. I feel like I've done all that I can do. And it's fun to have somebody pick up the baton and go, no, I can take it. Let me run with this from here. And they have fresh legs and fresh eyes and often take it in unexpected or new directions. So it's not an intentional choice to abandon the projects, but there's definitely moments where I just go, I think I've given this all I have. I wonder if this could continue on. I've been lucky that a lot of these projects, a lot of stuff that I've worked on, someone has said like, yeah, I'd love to take it from here and run with it.
Well, and it's a skill set that you have. Multi-venture entrepreneurs have. They are also called serial entrepreneurs. They are really experts in the startup. They're experts at seeing an opportunity, kind of harnessing it, building it up to a certain level. And then they know, like you're talking about, it doesn't matter. That just seems to be what I'm hearing from you is you're very curious and you see an opportunity and you kind of start it and start getting some momentum with it. And then you pass it along.
Yeah, I think some of that is my work at BuzzFeed too, because BuzzFeed, I was always really interested in this and launched a lot of little things. And BuzzFeed is where I went, oh, people can do this at a much bigger scale. And here's what that's like. Because the company was full of folks who had launched things. And at BuzzFeed, we were just always launching new projects, new ideas. Some of which were big successes and many of which were not. And what I loved about BuzzFeed is we just never got discouraged when stuff didn't work. You know, we'd launch something and go, this is great. We think people are going to love it. And the audience would go, I'm not that interested in that. We go, okay, no, that's fine. Don't worry about it. We got another thing coming next week. Try that. See if you like that. And the failures, we never really got too down on those because there were always going to be more ideas and more things to launch. It's one of those things that that stuck with me over the years. I don't get too down when stuff doesn't work because there's always going to be another idea. There's always going to be something else. And I think some folks get worried, you know, what if this is, I have to hold on. There was a former colleague at BuzzFeed, Zay Frank, who has this great YouTube video about this idea he referred to as brain crack, which is you have these ideas and they're in your head and you're like, this is the perfect idea.
Yeah.
It's the perfect idea. I just have to work on it forever, just a little bit and after a little bit, and I'm going to hold on to it. It's my perfect idea. And they're afraid to put it out into the world for fear that, what if I put it out into the world and I never have another idea? It's like, no, you're going to have more ideas. Don't worry about it. Don't hang on to it too long. Like, put it out into the world. See what people think. Get people talking about it. Make it better. And if it doesn't work, you move on to the next thing. Don't worry too much about it. There's always going to be more. I'm definitely, whatever fear there might have been that, I don't think of myself as a serial entrepreneur, but I definitely might be a serial creator of some sort. Like, there's just always more stuff to make.
You might be a serial, you know,
Yeah, I don't know what the phrase is, but whatever it is, I just do a lot of stuff. Some of it is good and some of it isn't, but when it isn't, I move on to the next thing, try to focus on the good.
Well, in our second conversation, we'll talk in more depth about your role as a director of newsletters at BuzzFeed and how you built out the team that grew newsletters into one of the biggest referrers of traffic to the site and drove 250 million clicks to BuzzFeed. You also wrote a bunch of posts. Before we close out this conversation, I was wondering, 10 years later of blogging, 850 posts, what comes to mind as you build your, in your list of learnings about what you want people to know about building content?
I think I said it earlier, but I'll say it again, consistency, picking something that you think you can do on a regular basis, even if it's small. I want to write 200, a lot of my blog posts are really short, 250, 350 words, but it's, hey, I think I can write 300 words every week. Start there, start small. And the other thing too is try to build habits, even if the medium that you publish it could be podcasting, it could be video, it could be creating events, it could be whatever. It doesn't have to be writing on the page that people read, but getting into the habit of writing on a regular basis, I think, is super important. I, not coincidentally, about the time that I started the blog, there was this great app that used to exist called Olife, O-H-L-I-F-E. And every night they would email you and go, what did you do today? And then you would write back to this thing, this email, and it would save it in a doc. And it would, you know, also email you later on and go, hey, a year ago, here's what you said. It shut down a bunch of years ago. I kept it going. I built a little, not app, it's a thing using a tool called Zapier that emails me in the same question, and I email back, and it all gets saved in this big text document. And every night I get in the habit of writing something about the day. It's just a journal, essentially. That's all.
Yeah.
But it makes sure that every day I write, even if I've had a million calls or a bunch of projects or it's been a weird day, I always write something. And I find that just being in the habit of doing that on a regular basis, if you have a fear of, you know, I get stuck on the words, I don't have the right words, I'm nervous about starting, I'm not a good writer, just getting into the habit of doing it on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen right away, but over time, if you write a little something every day, eventually you look back and you go, I mean, I look back on this doc, at this point it's, you know, thousands and thousands of entries, and I must be in the tens of thousands of words, if not hundreds of thousands of words at this point. It's a novel at this point, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
I look back and go, I wrote a lot. You know, even on days when I didn't think I was writing, I was still writing. I still made time for it. So it's that consistency of publishing, consistency of building the habit of writing. And if you do that sort of thing over time, eventually you start to get to a place where you go, actually, my writing's a little bit better. Or maybe if you're really lucky, this writing's pretty good.
Yeah, right.
It takes time.
Oh, definitely. Well, those are really, critical skills in getting started, and also just growing something is really consistency in how you're publishing, you know, whatever it is, and building some habits in writing every day like that.
Yeah.
And writing something that you don't need to necessarily even edit. Right? You just write it.
No, if I tried to, you know, I couldn't publish the diary. I couldn't publish it as a blog post or a book because it would be too filled with grammatical errors. It would take years to edit into some sort of shape or narrative. But still, publishing, being consistent, this is the good stuff. This is a lot of the best stuff comes from just getting into the right habits.
Yeah. And what do you write on? Do you hand write? Do you have Google Doc journals that you write in? How do you write?
It's a good question. It's literally, I've set up this thing that I get an email every night that says, what did you do today? And I hit reply and write back to it. And it takes the text that I write and adds it to a text document on my computer.
Oh.
So I just have this very long text document with all of kind of my journal entries. I found that it's an easy way for me to do it because then I don't have to bring something with me, or if I'm traveling, you know, wherever I am, even if I'm on my phone, you know, it can be the end of the day and I get the email and I'm on an airplane and I can go, oh, I can reply real quick to this. I can type out something fast. It doesn't have to be an essay. It can be a couple sentences about what I did that day. Or, you know, at the end of the day today, I'll probably write something about the conversation we had or what I'm thinking afterwards, you know, about this particular conversation. But yeah, I can do it from wherever. So email has been really good for me because, again, it's just, how do I keep it as simple as possible? Let me just boil it down to the very basic elements. I just need a place to put the words in and hit send. And then, thanks to the magic of the internet, it puts it in the right place in the folder so I can find it later if I want it.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, terrific. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights about your life and just how your life as a reporter and journalist kind of has taken shape. And in our next conversation, we'll go into a few more details and learn about how you're building your business Inbox Collective. So thanks for being here, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks everybody for tuning in. And thanks Mike Abea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And we'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.